USA, I want to encourage the possibility of a Team Canada development, a group of people worried or interested about how you go from LHC data to theoretical models. So the LHC is going to give us data in 2 years. And the question we all want to know is, are we ready yet? And I'm not sure how people feel in the quantum gravity or the string theory communities, but certainly in the model building community, the particle physics community, we're in a state of panic. And we're in a state of panic for two reasons. One is panic, a more soul-searching kind of panic, thinking about Anthropics, thinking about fine-tuning. We see that all our best models for what the LHC should find tend to be fine-tuned. And so we have this little hierarchy problem. We have many, many different ways of solving the big hierarchy problem, the gauge hierarchy problem, supersymmetry, technicolor, so on and so forth. I should have mentioned Randall Sundrum models work back anyway. But all those models, when you implement them, have a little hierarchy problem that while you've solved the big tuning from the Planck scale down to the electroweak scale, there's still usually a part in 1 to 1 in 100 tuning, additional tuning in model space that you have to do in order to get those theories to work. And so we're doing soul searching. We're in a panic. Will the LHC see anything? Should we take this little hierarchy problem as a sign of some other mechanism at work? But OK, putting that aside, even more, more pressing is just the practical problem. And this is this. When the first slide of the first data of the first talk on the LHC is presented, will we have any idea what that first slide means? When the experimentalists give us the data, will we know how to interpret it? And this is the motivation for starting the LHC Olympics, to give theorists a chance to see what fake data looks like. So by the time the real data comes along, we'll have some expectation for what should it look like. Is it weird that this plot has this bump in this place? And there's no better way of figuring out how difficult this process is than just doing it. And so again, the point of the LHC Olympics is to give theorists access to fake data and use that fake data as a learning tool. And you'll be surprised at what level this learning tool can act on. At the LHC Olympics back in February, an undergraduate was able to struggle with the data and come to some interesting conclusions. As I said before, Herman Verlinde and Leonardo Rastelli, string theorists, were able to learn something about particle physics and LHC phenomenology, and I think we're the real winners of the LHC Olympics. Then you have a team at Harvard who has been studying a little bit more about that, and we learned something about the specifics of the detectors, the kind of challenges you have working with a real detector and not just computer simulation. And people who are thinking farther down the line really want to make contact with experimentalists, take this game, which it is at this point of the LHC Olympics, and turn it into a way to have a discussion about what standard model backgrounds are important, what models to simulate are important, and get a dialogue between theorists and experimentalists that will hopefully make it easier for us to interpret what will undoubtedly be ambiguous data. So, yeah.
At this point, I mean, is it really just an exercise for the theorists? I mean, are the experimentalists going to learn something? Like, do they know already what that first slide, what the axes on that first slide is going to be? Or are they going to learn what they should put on the first slide?
The comments that we got from, so this is the slide for the first LHC Olympics. The second LHC Olympics, we had a bunch of experimentalists show up. And what they said was that everything that we said in our presentations about our analysis of these black boxes, everything we said was absolutely reasonable. But they would have never put it together in the way that we did. That the way that they think about data is different than the way a theorist, when presented with data, thinks about data. And you know, some of it has to do with just how big the experiments are when you're working in an experimental collaboration. You usually have access to one trigger stream that you're trying to understand as well as possible, one subset of events that you're trying to get the most information out of. That's the way that an experimentalist attacks data coming out of a collider. The way a theorist attacks data coming out of a collider is to say, OK, what's the big picture? Do all the different hints I'm getting from all these different sectors, do they make sense? And that's something that experimentalists will eventually do, but certainly they were impressed by how quickly, as theorists, we did it, or how naturally we would do that. That we wouldn't take one bit of information in one area and try to refine it. We would just assume that that bit of information was roughly true and see if it had a correlated prediction on some in some other area. And that's not the way that experimental collaborations usually work. And maybe this, the LHC Olympics will serve to either broaden the influence or the access of theorists to data, or more likely just to have informal collaborations between theorists outside of CMS and Atlas and experimentalists within CMS and Atlas. So the experimentalists certainly learn things. More importantly, actually, than the experimentalists are the people who do phenomenology for a living, the people who put out 5-10 papers a year about a specific model and what it looks like at the LHC. And they learned things, too. They learned different intuition than what they had. They focused on one subset of models. They carried that intuition over another subset of models, and it had to be modified a little bit. And so by playing with data, you learn a little bit about how to refine your intuition about what things look like at the LHC. So the end goal is to make it useful for experimentalists. At this point, the main reason why experimentalists don't want to get involved at this point is that there is no standard model background. And without standard model background, this is very unrealistic. But as a learning exercise, we have to first see if we can understand what signal looks like. And in the next LHC Olympics in August, we are going to absolutely put the rudiments of standard model background in there and see what we can do with that. So this is kind of an iterative process, learning at many, many stages for people just wanting to get involved and hopefully to connect more with experimentalists.
Is there any sense that the experimentalists can still refine their triggers, or is this just orthogonal to that idea?
It's a done deal. Maybe if there are certain search channels that in very special models, we may need to change the trigger tables. But as far as I've heard from experimentalists, no model has come that doesn't at least get discovered using the current trigger tables, or would never get discovered because the standard model background is so huge. So we're not telling experimentalists, go redesign your experiments. We're saying, OK, this is what you've given us. Given what you've given us, what can we extract out of it? And that's the kind of that's the framework we're working in. So this is a slide from the first LHC Olympics. This is in July of 2005, was basically an organizational meeting. And at this meeting, I'll show you what the program of events was. At this meeting, it was very little about black boxes. It was basically talks in the morning. Talk by Grody King, talk by myself about kind of general strategies for how you might decipher data. And then the only person to actually tackle a black box was Matt Strassler, University of Washington. The group at University of Michigan made a black box, and Matt Strassler did an amazing analysis on this black box and really convinced the rest of us, wow, this is what you can learn from just studying strings of numbers. And the amount of physics he was able to get out of that was very, very impressive. And this set the stage for the second LHC Olympics. And the second LHC Olympics, I'm going to walk you through one of the black boxes for the second LHC Olympics. And I'm going to walk it through in the way that Herman Melinda and Leonardo Rosselli did it. These are people who started from ground zero. I'm going to start you from ground zero and get to a point where there's actually an interesting experimental question that needs theorist input at some level. Maybe it's theorist input in that you write a paper about it, and the experimentalist will see it and maybe put it into their analysis. Or better yet, a theorist actually sitting at the side of the computer when the data is coming in and says, oh, that looks like this kind of model. OK, so let me tell you a little bit more about what the LHC is, what it sees, give you a little bit of background information that we're going to tackle a problem, one of the black box problems, at a lower level for the second LHC Olympics. So I guess I can leave this up. Or I can put the slide in for the second LHC Olympics, assuming it loads. Assuming I have internet access. So what is the LHC? The LHC, as you know, is a 14 TeV center of mass PP collider. And the numbers you should have in your head for the reach of this machine is that electroweak, things that only have electroweak charges, you can pretty much see them if their masses are between 200 and 300 GeV. So if you have a model that predicts a 500 GeV Wino, you're never going to see it directly. You may see it through cascades, but this is kind of the upper limit for direct production of things that only have electroweak interactions. For things that have color charge, the kind of numbers to have in your mind are 1 TeV to 1.2 TeV. Things like gluinos, KK gluons, sparks, those kind of things you can have a reach to discovery potential up to 1 to 1.2 TeV. And for Z prime like resonances, you have a reach, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3 TeV. So the LHC is a resonance factory, it's a color factory, and if things are light enough and the standard model backgrounds aren't prohibitive, then you can see some electroweak stuff. In the context of supersymmetry, what you end up doing is, in order to get access to this electroweak stuff, you make colored stuff first and then decay to the electroweak stuff. And this is most of what the literature is about SUSY, is studying the cross-sections for the colored stuff and then the cascade decays that give you electroweak things with just electroweak charge. Now, a cartoon of an LHC detector. We have a proton beam, another proton beam. A collision happens. What do we measure at the LHC? Roughly speaking, we measure four vectors. We have, let's say, some particle comes off. We're able to measure the azimuthal angle for that particle. We're able to measure the transverse momentum of that particle. And we're able to measure the angle with respect to the beam line. And these three numbers are converted into a four vector, so you can get a four vector if you know the particle's mass. And sometimes you don't know, which makes things difficult. If you know the particle's mass, if you know what its transverse momentum is, if you know what usually they convert, experimentalists convert this angle with respect to the beam pipe into a pseudorapidity. Pseudorapidity zero means you're perfectly perpendicular to the beam pipe. Pseudorapidity large means you're along the beam pipe. And this azimuth angle, this is going to get you a four vector. And there you go. Particles collide, a bunch of four vectors come out. We can label these four vectors. In terms of where they deposit energy in the calorimeters, so just a general detector looking down the beam pipe. There are, in almost every detector, there are basically four regions. Region A is a trapping chamber. And in the trapping chamber, you see any charged particles, they will leave tracks in the trapping chamber. This will help you give a handle on the momentum of particles coming out. In region B, you have an electromagnetic calorimeter. And the electromagnetic calorimeter is where photons stop, where electrons and positrons stop, also where pi zeros, Photons and electrons stop dominantly. Region C is the hadronic calorimeter. And this is dominantly where colored stuff stops. And region D is the muon chamber. So given tracking information and energy deposition in the various calorimeter cells, we can figure out the four vectors for a bunch of particles. And the particle types relevant for the LHC and the particle types that we will give you in the LHC Olympics are just the following. We give you four vectors, and they are labeled as being either a photon, an electron, a muon. If a tau decays hadronically, we can tell that. So hadronic taus. If a tau decays leptonically, then it just puts extra information into the electron muon bins. We can tell jets. We can tell about heavy flavor tag jets, B jets, and some people are talking about C jets. We can then sum up all the energy in all the calorimeters and get a measure of missing energy. And that's it. Every event is a sequence of four vectors labeled by this information. And what experimentalists try to do is refine this information here, maybe give confidences on whether there's a photon, how much of it is of being photon or electron. But at the end of the day, their goal is to get the most accurate four vectors and the most accurate identification of particles of this type using those calorimeter cells. And so what the LHC Olympic starts off with is just this information. We take Pythia. Pythia is an event generation software. It collides two proton beams and gives you Monte Carlo truth information in the sense of the real particles that came out. Pythia is piped through a detector simulation called PGS, which was originally designed for CDF. And PGS converts this raw Pythia output into the types of particles that can be seen at the LHC. And PGS gets piped into your brain, where you have to figure out what the model of the universe is.
So the software that generates these events assumes some kind of model?
Assumes some kind of model. And so at the LHC Olympics this past time, there were three different models that people used. A model at the Harvard group was a combination of supersymmetry and some extra resonances. The model that the Washington group presented was some generic-ish supersymmetry. The model that Gordy Kane presented was some string-inspired construction, but also supersymmetry. The goal in the future is to be able to do any model, anything you want. It doesn't have to be supersymmetric. It could just be, I want five different times of leptode quarks, a couple of Z primes, and some missing energy. A stable particle that leaves missing energy. Whatever you want to put in, hopefully the goal is to be able to run that through the same train of logic and see if your brain can work back and figure out what the input was. So, you know, of course, in the real world, the real world is going to give you some input for the purposes of the LHC Olympics. It's someone like Gordy Kane, and you're trying to figure out the mind of Gordy. And it has been commented that maybe the best way to solve the LHC Olympics is just to go back through all of Gordy's papers and figure out what he said. And in this particular case, it would not have worked particularly well. OK, so this is the general framework.
But is there also the stuff to be done at that end?
At this end?
Yeah.
Coming up with an interesting model.
You know, I want to design a model, and I want to generate data.
So there's actually
compare it to whatever came out of the machine.
So there's actually three things that you can do at this stage. This is the way the research is done, first of all. Research is done where people say, I want this model, or in the case of what I'll talk about this afternoon, I want 40,000 models, and I want to pipe it through this algorithm. Right now, there's an active community, I think there was actually a conference at it maybe this week at Fermilab, to try to make it easier for theorists to put their own models into this stream. Because right now, it's only the only things that are available are what's been hard-coded in Fortran into Pythia, or hard-coded in Fortran into Herwig. The tools like MadGraph or CompHep that allow you to do kind of any process that you want aren't sewn together in the most effective way into these showering algorithms. So there's just a block there in terms of just being able to get a model. And as far as the LHC Olympics goes, the third thing is you really want to get an intuition for what very different models look like. That I've spent the past year and a half staring at SUSY models. I have a very good sense of what SUSY models look like. Someone showed me a plot from a universal extra dimensions model, and I said that couldn't be true. That's not right. It looks the whole wrong shape. But it was true that my intuition from looking at a subset of models was completely off. So there's a lot of work on this end to try to get the space of models to be more adequately filled out. But that's a hard part.
So what do you mean by saying that it was not true? True compared to what?
True compared to my intuition. That I was shown a graph. This is God. I was shown a plot. So someone said, I'm going to make a plot for you. And I said, OK, I predict that your plot is going to look like this. And I would have been right in the context of supersymmetry. And I'll show you an example of a plot line.
Any supersymmetric model would have given that?
Any supersymmetric model would have given that because of the fact that the spermions are scalars.
What are you plotting?
What am I plotting? I'll tell you what I'm plotting later. I'll tell you three different kinds of plots that will allow you to solve a mini LHC Olympics in this room today. And what this person showed me was a plot that looked like this. And my interpretation of this was, oh, this must be background, some kind of one over S-ish background on top of something that really looks like this. But when you have fermions in a decay, you often get structures that have this extra peak at this end. So whereas I would have interpreted this as background plus a signal, this actually was the signal. And so I just had something about angular.
If I saw that, that means I don't have supersymmetry.
And to the extent that you can disentangle this to background plus this, yes, that would be a way of telling that you didn't have supersymmetry. And so people are trying to come up with ways of how can you make this as robust as possible, this kind of analysis as robust as possible. So people are thinking in that direction. So, but in terms of model space, I would have never known this had someone not actually explicitly shown me a model where at tree level, this is what you get. So it's useful to have other things in your mind so that when the first slide of the first conference comes up, you can say, aha, that could either be background plus Susie or universal action directions. And know what those two differences are. Yeah.
So Pythia doesn't have the standard model background already.
So Pythia has some standard model background processes, but not the standard model background processes that you want for supersymmetry. So one of the classic things that supersymmetry gives you is it gives you four hard jets. So you have light enough gluinos, you get four hard jets and missing energy. In the standard model, how do you get four hard jets plus missing energy? Well, missing energy can come from a Z decaying via neutrinos. And so if you just want a tree-level process that's going to give you four hard jets plus missing energy, it's going to be four jets plus a Z. Four jets plus a Z is a 2-to-5 process. And people they started to calculate those kind of things, but no one knows the analog corrections to that.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the case, there are some standard model backgrounds in Pythia, and one of the goals of the LHC Olympics is to catalog all those standard model backgrounds relevant for all the models that we've ever come up with to encourage people to make these things available. So, and there's all sorts of fun issues about if you have initial and final state radiation on, then a process that has that whose hard process is four jets plus missing energy may have a component of five jets plus missing energy. And so you have to figure out how to adequately add that to a real five jets plus missing energy tree level process. So this program of MC at NLO that you might have heard about that's trying to both combine leading order and next to leading order calculations in a nice way, but also make sure you don't double count things. That you don't double count soft linear figuring out the multiplicity of jets.
So when people in this big conferences like LoopFest,
yes,
things like that, don't they also go through the same exercise of looking at the possible models on the kind of backgrounds, the emission from views or something?
Sure, absolutely. And yes. You look at the list and you look at the list and there's a bunch that haven't done yet. And so we'll go to the LHC with the backgrounds that we have, not the backgrounds we want. But we should be aware of them. That's one of the reasons why the organizers of the LHC Olympics have been hesitant to include standard model background if you don't do it in some somewhat correct way, or at least if you have the whole list of caveats that go along with it. Okay. So graphs like this. Where do graphs like this come from? So let me show you the graph that you are going to decipher in the next half hour. You are going to decipher the following graph. And this was the graph. This is from the Washington Black Box. And you can download this box for yourself. Two graduate students at Harvard have made a nice mathematical program that allows you to open it up and make all the plots you could ever want to make using just Mathematica. So if you can use Mathematica, it's slow, but you can analyze something like the Washington Black Box. And in the Washington Black Box, in events with two or more jets, they often had E plus E minus pairs. And when you plotted the invariant mass distribution of the E plus E minus, so you literally just take the four vector of the plus guy, add it to the four vector of the minus guy, and square it, you found the following feature. So this is the number of events. And this is the invariant mass for E plus E minus. In the Washington black box, you had a beautiful structure where this was at 70 GeV, and this peak was at 90 GeV. So every particle theorist, when they see a peak at 90 GeV, says, ah, there's Z's here. Basically, anytime you have any particle, it's called a particle X, decaying to two particles, if you construct the invariant mass of those particles, you're going to get a bump whose center is at the mass of that particle and whose width is a lifetime. What a lifetime. So you see this bump and you say there are Z's in this sample. What about this feature here? This is a feature that may be less familiar to you, but this is a feature that I've been drawing over here.
Isn't there a racer, by the way?
Features that have that kind of edgy type structure come not from two-body decays, so the peaks are coming from two-body decays, but edgy-like structures are usually coming from three-body decays. And so if you have particle X, particle Y, decaying in a three-body way, where you can't see Y, let's say Y is some stable supersymmetric particle like a state theory detector, all you see are the electrons, then what you see from this, if you were to plot the invariant mass of the E plus E minus, is you would see what's called an endpoint. And the value of this endpoint is at the mass of the X particle minus the mass of the Y particle. So if you see some distribution that just cuts off, and usually this is over some background, so often there's some either combinatoric or otherwise background, so you see some structure like this, and you say, aha, this looks something like an endpoint if I were to extrapolate it. And you say, we have some new particle, or a difference of two particles here, and X and MY. That's an endpoint. More interesting is if you have a decay that involves an on-shell, I guess I shouldn't call it Z, nor can I call it W. That's dangerous too. I'm going to just call it Z. If you have a series of two-body decays, so this Z is on shell. So if the Z were not on shell, you just go back to this case, but the Z is on shell, then what you see from this, if you were to plot the invariant mass of E plus E minus, is that you would see what's called an edge. And this edge is coming just from phase space. There's nothing special about this point. It's like taking a graph like this and just saying, oh, at some point I pull this in half, and I get some sharp edge in my distribution. And the value of this edge occurs at some value. Some complicated formula. There you go. Okay, so these are very simple kinematic things you can do. If you have a two-body decay, you're going to get yourself a resonance. If you have a three-body decay, if the three-body decay has no on-shell intermediate particles, it's just a three-body decay, then you're going to have an endpoint. And if there is a three-body decay that has an intermediate on-shell particle, you usually get an edge. And the value of that edge is less than what you would have had if the Z were on-shell. So if the Z went off-shell, this thing would have looked like this and then an endpoint. But with the Z on-shell, it gets a nice sharp edge in that form.
There are no signals past the edge.
Except for what it really looks like in real life. What it really looks like in real life is you have some background of some other junk, possibly other events that alter and contaminate the sample, and you have some structure sitting on top of it. So it's hard to tell really what is or is not an edge.
But
without a background, there's absolutely nothing beyond it. It's just kinematically inaccessible. There's no phase space for that to occur.
Your formula is so complicated, I can't read it. The denominator and the...
So it's basically the top you just go down in order of their mass, take the top squared minus the middle squared minus the bottom squared, divide by the bottom squared, take the square root.
Whole square. Okay. Sorry.
So it's a formula that actually the better thing to do is once in your life derive it for yourself, and then you'll never forget it again. But it's simple kinematics. It's simple kinematics that undergraduates can do. But it's
if you take the mass of the Z to infinity, you should go to the previous case, right?
Probably something like that. It's probably true.
Then it would become a free body.
I'm a little bit worried because this formula comes from the fact that you are solving for this two-body decay to have this thing on shell.
Yes.
And so you see what happens. If Z, set MZ equal to MX.
Yes.
If you set MZ equal to MX, then this thing is zero. So it's not a smooth interpolation between this object and this. If you want afterwards, I can show you a more diagrammatic Dalitz way of seeing exactly how these things relate to each other. But I just want to give you a sense that these are things you see. You see endpoints, you see edges, and these are roughly the mass scales of those things appear. Of course, everything gets smeared out in the detector.
So there's a very clear distinction between the two processes.
No, there's no clear distinction because in theory space, these things are very, very different. But in detector space, it's often hard to tell what you're seeing. So maybe I'll bring up. So if you go to the LAC Olympics page, you can download the black box data sets from Matt Strassler's website. He has a whole description about all the caveats you should have. And he has number two up there is the University of Washington black box. It's 25 inverse center bonus data. And part of that 25 inverse center variance contains, in events with two or more jets, this distribution of free plus and minus. And a whole bunch of other information that I can skim at leisure. But let's see how, and also, I should say, this is the Harvard black box webpage. This has information about the Harvard black box. But if you click on software, then this is some mathematical code that we've written called Chameleon that allows you to input the data in the raw LHC Olympics format and manipulate it like you would manipulate anything mathematical. It makes it very simple to make plots.
Yeah. So what constitutes solving the problem?
Solving the black box, you make a prediction. I think this is supersymmetry with the Albino-like LSP, with a Gluino at 700 GeV, and I don't know anything else about the spectrum. That's what you presented.
But can you extract? You're going to tell us that there is something much more than you can extract from data classes and the difference between masses.
I'm going to tell you that there's more. There's much more you can extract than just this stuff. Absolutely. For example, if you know the cross sections for certain events, then you have a handle on if you know what those particles are. And you know what their spins are, and you know how they couple, then you have a handle on their mass.
How knowing spins, this is a hadronic collider. So I thought that.
No, knowing the spin for, sorry, what I wanted to say is that knowing the cross section, you can figure out the mass of a particle. But to know what the cross section means in terms of the mass of a particle, you have to know the spin of that particle because there's a difference in the cross section for reducing something if it's a fermion or a scalar. There's factors of two that come in there. And so you could say, this is consistent with a fermion of this mass or a scalar of some other mass. That's what you could say. Or it's consistent with, if you have a bunch of scalars on top of each other, you could say it's consistent with n scalars of this mass, for example. So yes, there's much more information than you can get from just this, though it's hard to get information beyond this stuff that's simple to see without resorting to simulation, without saying, OK, here's what I think it is, simulate it and see how it compares to the actual data. But at least these are things that you can do just to see and visually say, OK, I've made a measurement at some point. OK, so this is the software that you can use, mathematical software you can use. And if you want to generate your own sample, you say, I think I figured out the theory that Gordy Kane has in his mind, you can use some event generation software to actually plug in your guess, simulate it, and then reanalyze it with this chameleon package and just compare how good are the graphs. And this is precisely what Leonardo Ristelli and Herman Verlinden did. They started from absolutely zero, and they were able to do a fairly good analysis with help from their experimental colleague on CMS, Chris Tully. And then both A bunch of us who were more familiar with the LEC Olympics kind of came down to Princeton, gave some visits, and guided them gently along towards an answer that turned out not to be the correct answer in the sense of the one that Max Strasser had actually inputted, but one that plausibly could have been true and probably would be true with standard model background. Okay, so let's see. How do I want to do this? I'll leave this at this. So basically, what they're doing is they're plotting a bunch of things to show that there's something interesting in this black box. They're plotting the invariant mass of all objects and all events, and they say, wow, the invariant mass for all objects and all events has a peak around 2000. 2000, 2 TeV. That means you're making something new. Okay, so now there's something beyond the standard model. And then they plot what the missing energy is, and you say, wow, there's missing energies up into the 800s, up into the 1 TeV range. They think about SUSY, they say there must be an LSP. And they go through some other arguments to justify, at least in their own heads, that it's SUSY. Most of them come from the fact that they know that this was generated with Pythia, and Pythia only generates SUSY. But what about this mystery here? What about this here? So we have a peak, so we have events with 2 plus jets, and we have evidence for Zs. So we have events that have 2 or more jets, and we have Z bosons in those events. And we have this extra stuff. So this extra stuff, based on the two things I've told you over here, could either be just a 3-body decay or a succession of 2-body decays. So given the shape of that distribution, what would you guess this was? Would you guess this is an edge or an endpoint? You would guess this is an edge and you'd be wrong. But let's say it is an edge. Okay? Let's say it is an edge. How are you going to get this edge? What process is going to give me, what process in the context of supersymmetry can give you an edge in dielectrons? Okay, so somehow we have some process that gives me an E plus and an E minus, and I'm telling you that this is supersymmetry. What are the names of these particles here? What are some possible names of the particles here? So let's think about conserving lepton number. So we have some lepton here. Either this needs to have some interesting lepton number, or this line needs to have some lepton number. So let's say this line has some lepton number. Then what particle in SUSY has electron lepton number? And that would be a slepton or a selectron. In order to generate a selectron, it can come from one of the electroweak enos. So it could come from probably not a Higgs eno, but more likely a Wino-like neutral eno or a Beno-like neutral eno. And then at the end of the day, we can have an LSP. So the very first time I visited Princeton, they were very proud of themselves. They had found this edge. They say it must be a 3-body decay. And it must be something like this. It must be some electroweak eno. Eno gives off an E, a C, an E minus, and the LSP. That was their prediction. And they ran that prediction, and they found the following. They found that here was some Z that they got from some other place, and they found that their plot looked like this.
Can you tell, what does it mean to run a prediction at that stage? So once you make an assumption, then you...
Yeah, then you go into Pythia, there's a table of particles and their masses, and you say, I want this mass, this mass, this mass. I know that there must be some mass difference, that's 70 GeV. And you diagonalize your neutral eno or charge eno mass matrix in order to get that to be correct. and then you simulate in the exact same way that you simulated data to create the black box. So it involves knowing, you have to make some guesses about some other aspects of the spectrum. You don't want to go simulating right away. You want to figure out as much as you can without having to simulate.
Do I need to input your color top?
No. Those are. I mean, yes, you do, but there's the default values are correct.
What's
the standard model? The fact that in supersymmetry the Yukawa coupling the standard model Yukawa coupling shows up in the superpotential means that by knowing what the standard model masses are and knowing what tan beta is, you already know what that coupling is.
Okay.
So once you know tan beta, then that's fixed.
So there is an assumption like minimum standard. Minimal supersymmetric standard.
Yes, this is working in the context of the minimal supersymmetric standard model for the reason that this is the only thing that's coded in Pythia. You would love to be able to do a more model-independent strategy where you just start adding vertices by hand or dots.
Okay.
Are
you making the assumptions about supersymmetric breaking parameters?
The assumptions that Pythia makes is that, so you can change all of them to be whatever you want, but Pythia doesn't allow you to split the first two generations. It assumes some kind of flavor universality. And you can split left-handed and right-handed fermions. You can split the third generation any way you want. You can change A terms any way you want for just the third generation. So there's something that Pythia does not allow you to do. You may want to have a more complete SUSY simulation. I think SmatGraph is one that allows you to adjust more than those. Also, Pythia assumes that all phases are zero. So there are a bunch of assumptions built into the event generation software that eventually we would like to be able to get beyond. But because for this exercise we knew what generated the software, what generated the data, and we had that exact same generator in front of us, we can play a game where we start from the assumption of supersymmetry and start looking things around.
So that's a much more restrictive thing than what would happen in the real world.
Oh, absolutely.
If you're making an assumption.
Sure.
Effective action is already.
Absolutely. At the end of the day,
right.
At the end of the day, this is not what you want to do, and it's certainly not what the experimentalists are going to do. But as a learning process, this is the perfect thing to do because it means that Herman, with very little effort, can make his own model of the universe and see, oh my goodness, that peak is way too big.
But you mean adjusting parameters?
He did his best, he moved things all around, and he said, geez, I just can't get the size of this thing to be small enough. The reason why he couldn't get the size of this thing to be small enough, because given an electroweak enos usually have a fairly large branching ratio to electrons to electrons. And so the branching ratio is too big. This is basically, this peak is the number of E plus, E minus from this selectron decay. And there's just too many of them. So the conclusion that they came up with is this must be gone. You can't have this process in the game. There was no consistent way to get the ratio of the Z peak to this thing to be even remotely close. So that peak must not be coming from this process. Okay. So any other guesses where you could get dileptons coming from a three-body cascade decay? That's what this structure seems to be suggesting. But to have somehow a smaller branching ratio.
More
stupid people, questions.
From people, you basically people sit in front of the software and play around and generate the intuition.
Yeah.
So that's the only way to learn this.
That's the way I learned it. It's amazing. So when you have 10 people at Harvard all sitting in a conference room, we have the Mathematica software up, people are typing away, often have dueling laptops, so that because it takes Mathematica a long time to make one plot. And Nima will say, it must be this. And I say, no, it can't be that. Two different machines generate the different possibilities. You show them and see which one is more like the truth. It's the best. I mean, it's not the only way. You can read all the literature, and everything's in there. But the only way to get intuition for it is to be convinced of how stupid one is. And when Herman now has an infinite appreciation for this, the fact that he spent days trying to get this to work. Because it looks like an edge. It really looks like an edge. And the only way to get that edge in the context of surface symmetry was to have an on-shell slept on. And so being led down that path, and he just couldn't make it work. So does he, I think he may even say this in his talk. His first guess, a cascade like this. You have a squark. Is this the pointer in Canada? We have a squark that gives off a jet, goes to one of the neutralinos, gives an opposite sign lepton pair with an on-shell slepton, and then the last neutralino goes through with missing energy. That was what this hypothesis that I just erased was. And he simulates it. Try and simulate, couldn't quite do it. And then he waits a while, and I think he waits until Brent Nelson comes up from Penn and says, oh, why don't you try something else? What if this structure here was not coming from an on-shell thing? It looks like an edge. It looks like an edge. I just told you edge comes from on-shell. But what if it was really an endpoint, but for some reason the amplitude was such that the amplitude forced things to really be kind of squeezed towards a z-peak. In particular, imagine you have an electroweak eno decaying from an electroweak eno to an off-shell z that then decays to e plus e minus. If you just go by phase space, what this will look like is it would look like this. But the propagator for the z, in terms of as expressed as the invariant mass of these guys, is 1 over s is the invariant mass of e plus and e minus, minus mz squared. And so we see that this thing is largest when s is as close to mz as possible, as kinematically possible. So even though this is a free body decay, because this s is in the s channel for the e plus e minus, this will also give you a structure that looks very much like an edge. An edge not because of kinematic reasons, because of phase space reasons, but an edge because of amplitude reasons, that this thing really wants to push the invariant mass as close to the ZP as possible. Again, this was a 70 GeV below the ZP. So we have two things going on in the description of this process. The two things going on are that we have some cascade that gives us an on-shell Z, and some cascade that gives you an off-shell Z. And that will reproduce this graph. Now, it's at this stage in the game that the experimentalists were impressed with us when we presented this at the LHC Olympics, because instantly, everyone in the room said, oh, it must be that one of these two particles must have a substantial Higgs eno fraction. So for an experimentalist, the way they think about supersymmetry is often in terms of just the eigenvalues of the neutralino mass matrix. But something a theorist knows right away is that there's no ZZZ vertex. And so the only way to get a Z coming off from of an electroweak eno is to have that electroweak eno be somewhat Higgs eno-like. And this is the kind of information that theorists have in kind of instant recall, that experimentalists, they have papers that say it for them. But we have a Z and a Z star, we must have two fields that both have Higgs eno components. That's something that's more automatic to a theorist. So the experimentalists, if they were to combat this, obviously, kind of simple and contrived example, they would have benefited from having someone in the room to say, oh, it must be, you know, like particles involved in this. So here's the reason why I think Herman should be the winner of the LHC Olympics for this last round. So he figured out, it must be a Z star. And figured out that you must have the Higgs eno relatively light. And he predicts a model. This model has the soft parameters that get fed into Pythia. He says, this is my model. Tell me how good my model is. Let me sketch for you what his model was. His model was the following. He said, so this is the Relinding-Ostelli model, and we'll compare it to the Harvard model. And we can then compare it to the real answer. The Relinding-Ostelli model was the following. Decouple the Wiener. We need to have states that are close together. Let's make them abino-like and Higgsino-like. Think states close together. Of course, the Higgsino has two neutralino states. So that, and through mixing with the B, you actually get a splitting of the physical states. And what they claimed was this decay here, this mass difference was 70 GeV. And so this is where you were getting your off-shell Z's from. And good, we have a Higgsino component in that. That's great. And then Higgsino component of this guy decaying here. It was heavier than 90 GeV. And that's going to give you that small level free. This is the Relinding-Ostelli model. And I think this was, for certainly for string theorists, a pretty amazing guess to make. And it works pretty well. And they go through, they have their experimentalist friends, again on CMS, run this model through and run it through a huge series of tests. And here are the plots. I think the bottom is, the top is there, the bottom is the real one. And you see that qualitatively, these plots look very similar. And then they had their experimentals go, and basically the story here is that everything is pretty dead on, except for one little pathology. Okay, anyway, plots that all look the same. The red dots and the black dots are very similar to each other, that's what you should learn. I'm very proud of the Princeton group for doing that. They happen to be wrong, and what the Harvard group proposed instead was the following, which seems absurd. The Higgsino is up here. The Wiener is down here, and the Beano is down here. And this mass splitting is less than 70 GeV, or is equal to 70 GeV. Well, how does this make sense? There's not that much, because the mu is heavy, there's not that much mixing between these and the Higgsino components. So these don't have that much in the Higgsino component. How are you getting Z stars out of this? Then you're expecting to get your Zs from these decays. Well, when you put it in numerically, it happens to work. It happens to be that there's just enough Higgsino component to get the off-shell Zs. And by dialing the mass of this mu, you can make that more or less better. And if you dial the mass of the Wiener and the Beano a little bit, you can get the right number of off-shell Zs. And so this happens to be the qualitative correct spectrum. But from a theorist's mind, actually, this may have been the better model. And in fact, when you plot them, the difference between those are very, very similar.
What is the pathology?
What is the pathology in this one? And why doesn't it work?
Yeah.
It doesn't work because it didn't match the actual model. But the real reason that you can tell the difference between these models is in something that is standard model background dependent. If you look at the cross section for direct production of these guys, I can't remember. Let's see, which way does it go? Because you're colliding protons, you don't have that much third generation stuff in your collision. And that means it's hard to make Higgsinos directly. It's much easier to make Wienos directly. And so if you look at events that have no jets, direct production of this junk, then you can more easily directly produce that guy than you can directly produce this guy. And so you see that they don't have enough or too much, depending on how they have to shift the spectrum around, of events that had no jets in them. But events that have no jets have huge standard model backgrounds. There's a standard model process where you just have dot boson pair production, just making W's and Z's that have the exact same decay topology as making these guys, because the missing energy just looks like a neutrino. So huge standard model background, and we tried to see how the standard model background affected that story. But it's a very subtle reason why these two models don't work. Now, we happen to be right. The reason why we happen to get it right is that we had 3,000 CPU hours to generate models of both kinds, and then we found that the chi-squared fit, this one happened to be better. So we kind of cheated. We had a supercomputer available to us to make that distinction. But from a theorist's mind, both of these are reasonable possibilities, and then it takes more thinking. Is there a better hammer to separate these two possibilities? Yeah.
So what is the reasoning to get to the other?
How did we get on this model? So the way that we got on this model is we said the absurd thing. We said maybe there's just enough Higgs xenomixing in this one, and you got the mass difference to be you set the masses to be correct, and then we scanned over all parameters and just did an exhaustive search, and the search stopped when we had to get on the plane to Geneva, and this was the best model in the half hour before the plane left. So, and it was accurate to within 5%. A little too accurate. So there's no standard model background here, so we were, again, able to cheat a little more. Or able to match all elements and stuff. And so to give you a sense of how this actually played out at the actual conference, John Killich, who's a grad student at Harvard, presented his analysis, and he presented it like a proof. He went through and basically said, and I'll get to the section on dileptons. He went through, he said, there's a very clear kinematic feature. That's that same plot as the drawing over there. This feature is most likely an endpoint arriving from a Z star. He just instantly said that as if it were proof. But of course, there's this whole other story. Well, maybe it could have been a slepton, and that's, of course, we went through that argument. But he presents it as a proof. Must be a gay genome. He claims all these things. Said must be this, must be this, must be this. Well, it's true. It was that. But there was this whole other argument, and I go through the slide and figure out what loophole made this fall through the cracks. But I was very impressed with the Princeton group, and I think other groups can do similar kinds of analyses to find. In this case, this is an example of a degeneracy. Two things that we really would have to duke it out on the archive to figure out if this were the situation of the LHC. Which is it? Is it a Beano-like LSP with a Higgs-Beano-like NLSP, or a Beano-like LSP with a Weino-like NLSP? Completely different predictions for dark matter, or thermorelic dark matter. Completely different predictions for what UV theory you might think would spit out these soft masses. So an important question to try to address. And I can show you then that Strassler. Showed the parameter file basically the same. This list is the same as the list that Herman showed. Here were the input parameters he used to generate his model, and it happened to be this kind of hierarchy compared to this one. But it's an interesting question. It's an interesting physics question. Everyone at the conference learns a huge amount. So my invitation to you, there's going to be a LHC Olympics, the third LHC Olympics. It's probably going to be at Santa Barbara this year. And there's going to be new black boxes presented. If you're interested in getting started, I would recommend getting started with the old black boxes because there are solution sets available for you, and you can just see, okay, how do I use the software? Can I get this information? Do I understand this whole chain of logic? And once you do that, you have a chance to really learn a lot about LHC phenomenology. There's also the possibility of publishable work in this area. For example, the Harvard black box was the first time in the literature. Well, it's not in the literature. First time that anyone has presented a method of determining SUSY from the decays of exotic spin 1 resonances. That was kind of exciting. We didn't even think about that aspect of the model when we made it. And one last thing about the LHC Olympics. Nature wrote a brief 2-page thing I can show it to you that has a funny introduction. That normally the trick to learning something at a scientific meeting is to listen to the key lectures. But one afternoon last month in a conference room at CERN, the European Particle Physics Lab near Geneva, physicist Matt Strassler managed to convince several researchers that they might learn more if they left the lecture room. He wanted them to avoid hearing the solution the public had been working on for months. A funny introduction to a funny article about the strange world of the LHC Olympics, theorists playing with fake data, trying to figure out the mysteries of the mind of another researcher, I guess. So I'll take questions and then here.
So
So in the context of the examples that you discussed, is that the only possible way that, I mean, you looked at a particular example when there was a left on in the middle. Are there some other process within the minimal supersymmetric standard model
that they would have given that? We thought about it a lot, and it was proved by exhaustion that there was nothing else. And that isn't to mean that there isn't something.
But there is a finite, in principle, there is a finite number of
things. There's a finite number of things, and you can generate all of them. In fact, if you go to SmatGraph will literally print out all the tree-level diagrams that you can draw with any given decay topology. What we've learned is you start small, you start building up, you start making hypotheses, and think the way a theorist does. Thinking the way a computer does is not actually very effective. Let me show you what, in John's talk, this highlighted. Thinking the way that a computer does, a computer goes through and tries everything, and you don't know why things are working or why they aren't. And when we actually thought about the Michigan black box, you can see this is the intuition that we got. This is where we guessed things were without ever running the simulation. This was just plotting things using this Mathematica tool. And then when we simulated, things settled down onto specific numbers, but the same patterns of things were exactly the same. That it's actually, you use your brain to say, well, this plausible, implausible, it may not be the only one. Of course, if you're trying to find degeneracies like this, you want to test all possibilities. But if the goal is to find a solution and present it with confidence, then using your brain is one effective way of doing it. And actually, probably a better, for the success of the LHC Olympics, having different people coming up with different answers is a better way of spurring discussion than to have a Harvard group with 10 graduate students and 3,000 CPU hours say, oh, we think this is the model. That's a way of, unfortunately, bulldozing what could have been some excellent discussions. It would have been great if their model looked a little better than ours. And then it turned out that our model was the right one. That would have been sociologically a better way of getting more people involved and saying, wow, this is actually pressing issues of our time in the pre-LHC era.
So if we join the LHC Olympics, we're all going to get good at understanding supersymmetric models and data. So is that going to be enough?
Probably not. If you actively part, so the LHC Olympics happens every 6 months. Mm-hmm. If you participate in the next one, you'll be seeing supersymmetry. Well, first of all, I think you should be glad that it's starting off with supersymmetry because already there's so much phenomenology there, and it's well documented in the literature that it's a good starting place. The next LHC Olympics is going to have a non-SUSY signal with standard model background in it. And that's going to be a challenge for people who want a challenge. And then future LHC Olympics, so for example, the fact that I'm involved in the LHC Olympics and I care about little Higgs theories means that you bet one of the LHC Olympics models is going to have a little Higgs theory or a composite Higgs theory or a UED-like theory in there because I'd be fascinated to learn the difference between SUSY and all the non-SUSY variants. So I think if you follow the trajectory of the LHC Olympics, you'll see, well, there's not that much time before data comes. But hopefully we'll cover enough of the bases that we'll be somewhat prepared for that first slide on the first day, first time. But if you're interested if you know better ways of coding up non-SUSY theories, let me know and it may be doable for the next one. But right now all the tools are really complicated. And you couldn't have this nice thing that Herman was able to verify a claim by actually doing a simulation. That was a nice piece of it. Because just saying, oh, I think it's this, well, you don't have some proof of concept in it. It's not as impressive.
Right, but sort of as a community, where are we or where are you going to be when that first slide comes up? I mean,
it depends. It depends on when or why the first slide comes up. No one has any idea what the data from the LHC is, how the data from the LHC is going to be presented. If they see a Z prime within the first 6 months, then that's going to be the talk of the first talk. It's going to be all about getting that Z prime information as good as possible. If it's more ambiguous, they're going to say, look, we see 2-3 sigma effects in these channels, and we need to wait to take more data. And it's not clear what form the data is going to take. Will it take the form of plots? Will they publish the data online? How much will theorists get involved in it? It's unclear. And make part of the LHC Olympics, at least those of us who are actively involved in it, are forging relationships with experimentalists to make sure that we have some access to the data at a level that we can communicate with it. Because if it's just plots, it's hard to understand. This is a very different machine than the Tevatron. The Tevatron, the hardest thing that the Tevatron found were TOPS. TOPS have a lot of decay products. TOPS are really hard to reconstruct. Supersymmetry has even more decay products. It's going to be even harder to figure out what's going on in supersymmetry. So if it is one of these kind of cascading kind of models where you have progenitors that are colored that decay to a bunch of other things, it's going to be hard to reconstruct the decay chains, and there's going to have to be this back and forth probably between theorists and experimentalists to nail it down. But I'm not sure what format's going to take, whether they're going to wait for 3 years to release any results until they're confident that they know what the model is. That may be what will end up happening.
But I guess part of it was more, you know, what if it's not supersymmetry? We all know it's supersymmetry because that's what string theory tells us.
Right. Like,
you know, what if it isn't? I mean,
if it isn't supersymmetry, how will it be presented? Okay.
I guess that's the first question: how will it be presented? But then, you know, given something, I mean, are people going to be prepared? You know, is there going to be software that you can run some kind of simulations to generate plots, or is it?
They're
all up for grabs.
Right now, it's all up for grabs. Right now, it's whatever people get done in the next few years is what's going to be used. So that's why some of us are in a panic state, trying to figure out what the best models to propose people spend 6 months of coding time working on. If it's easy stuff, if it's a bunch of resonances, say a KK tower of things, the experimentalists are going to have no trouble figuring out what it is. Oh, it's a tower of resonances. They can measure the spin of those resonances, and so on and so forth. Anything more complicated than that, for which they don't have simulation tools, will have to stare at the data and then try to come up with the appropriate simulation tools to address it. I'm not sure how it's going to work. I have no idea how it's going to work. Even if it's SUSY and it's outside of the constrained MSSM or the M-Suger scenario, I'm not sure how many people are prepared even for that situation. Everyone has a program on their laptop that the data comes in, they can scan around M-Suger space and find the best four-parameter fit to data. But if that doesn't fit, where do you go from there? Some people have gauge-mediated models on their computer. Some people have anomaly-mediated models on their computer. If they don't fit, what do you do then? So it's a wide, wide open field. And unfortunately, there's only 2 years left before the first data will be released. So LHC Olympic, I don't think anyone who's doing really theoretical stuff is going to drop everything and start calculating NLO calculations to make sure we get all the standard model backgrounds correct. But some of us are going to spend some time doing LHC Olympics-like research, or not even research, more like play, just to make sure we're in the right frame of mind to see the kind of data that comes out of the LHC.
Well, that was another question. I mean, you mentioned several times that we don't even know what the backgrounds are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what is it that the experimentalist is really going to present to you?
It depends on how honest they are. If they're really, really honest, what they're going to say is, here are the channels for which we think we know all the backgrounds, and these are the only channels we're going to show you. And that may or may not be useful to someone who's thinking about it.
Would they have shown you that graph?
Maybe not, because if they don't believe that they know the background, two jets plus two leptons plus missing energy. So what is that? Two jets plus two leptons plus missing energy. One source of that is it's just jet ZZ. If they don't have a jet ZZ coded up, they may not show it. And to get jet ZZ correct, even if they're just doing a tree level, they're going to have to do three jets and two Zs, because there's a chance that jets will overlap. And I don't think that's available. They may show it. You can estimate it. They could put an estimate on their plot. Well, this is, you know, what we think the standard model background might look like. Or if it has such an interesting shape, they may show it too, because the background, you don't expect a background to have that kind of shape in the standard model. So as long as that structure appeared over some, yeah.
Well, you have much better intuition than anybody else in the room, I'm sure. But so if you estimate or you think about what the background would be, would you see that structure there?
You wouldn't see this little C peak at all. That would be completely.
But that other feature would.
That other feature, you would, it would, it, yeah. So actually, if John actually tried to do this. He tried to figure out how. Let's see. File autonomous. Yeah. So this is a picture of the background and the signal, and you certainly see something between 25 and 25 GeV. So you see something. Whether you would know what the actual shape of that it looked like in an edger and endpoint, I'm not sure. But he, with the limited background sample that we had, it did not include the full JetZZ. There was some suggestion that it might work. So, but no, those are important studies to be done, and that's what's going to happen at the LHC Olympics progresses, is to make it more realistic, try to get closer to where the experimentalists are. Yeah.
How would your discussion change if, as you said, if the background wouldn't see the small peak coming from?
If you didn't see on-shell Zs, if you saw no on-shell Zs, then there's many more possibilities for where things come from, because you don't have to reproduce some heavy state decaying down. So you need to have two mass differences. You have to have one mass difference that's 70 GeV, and another mass difference that's greater than 90 GeV. And you may be able to fiddle around if you didn't have to match that Z peak. You may be able to fiddle around more with where the spectrum comes from, what the spectrum looks like.
Where 90 comes at all?
Oh, how do I know that there's a mass difference greater than 90? Because I see on-shell production of a Z. And so there has to be some.
I think you're doing, because that's in the background.
So sorry, that's what I meant. Is that you don't have to have, I mean, I said it backwards. You don't have to have a mass difference greater than 90 in that situation. I'm not sure what my first guess would be. My first guess might be, if I saw that scenario, my first guess might be a Higgsino LSP that was split to be 70 GeV because these guys were close by. But then I think you'd still get Zs from those as the case. So
but as long as you got a small enough branching ratio, you would say that that's lost in the background.
Right. So yeah, that would be my first guess, but I'd have to simulate it or check the branching ratio. Okay, this is a pass through.
Thank you for the second talk.